CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. Burnaby is located on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Halkomelem and Squamish-speaking peoples. Welcome to Intravenous, everybody. I am Rebecca.
And I am Pranjali.
And we are hosting today, unfortunately, without Robin. It's so sad she couldn't join us for this conversation, but we do have a really interesting topic to talk to you guys about today. I'd say it's probably more Pranjali talking than me. Just maybe I pose some interesting questions and thoughts. But yeah, I mean, I'll let you take it away in introducing.
I think it's this conversation is more of a continuation of a show that happened in August or September. I can't even remember now.
I feel like it was a blur. Yeah.
Everything honestly is a blur. So yeah, we were just chatting about like how there needs to be a subjective and feminist lens when talking about like data and questions of like power. When you talk about like implementation of certain technologies and their like very material implications on people and how like we actually interact with technology in a very like social, cultural, and political aspect. And there's just so much to talk and I don't even know where to start, but thank you so much for having me.
Yes, of course.
I look forward to chatting more about sociology because that's your background.
Yeah. I know we dived into it a little bit during that episode, but we couldn't get too deep into, like, I think it was, we were particularly looking at objectivity, because obviously sociology has a different kind of understanding of it and justification for it. But we'll definitely dive into all of that. I think we'll start with a song, though, and I think we will start with your song, if you want to introduce it. I've never heard of this artist before.
But I like... So they're like a Canadian artist, so it's a CanCon content, which is a requirement at our radios here. So they are an artist based here in Western Vancouver, and Western Canada, not Vancouver. And it's their second album, I believe, and it's their second track from that album called Honeycomb. I just like the poppy vibe. The song, nothing in particular, but I just enjoy Eva's music in general.
It's always great when you find music that you can just constantly go back to and just be like, yeah, I like that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is Honeycomb by Eva.
I'm not minding manners. I'm letting my groove shine.
Welcome back to Intravenous. I am Rebecca, and I'm the public affairs intern here at the station with kind of a very slight background in sociology and criminology, working towards a degree there. And I'm joined by...
I am Pranjali, and I am actually a... This feels very weird to say because I started as an undergrad, like working here at the radio station, and now I'm a master's student, so that's kind of cool. So my area of study in the undergrad was communications and international relations. And then for my master's, I'm working on, specifically working on communications, and my interest is in like studying science and technology studies. Which is a very, very broad theme, which includes inspecting how science is conducted, what does it mean to do science, and so, like, a humanities perspective on, like, data science is something that I look at. And I'm also working on my master's thesis, which hopefully, because I keep changing my topic all the time, hopefully I'm looking at, like, how border control technologies function and create identities of different people, and how like using specific AI and automated decision-making tools can or cannot like sort of like perpetuate violence and bias against people who try to travel and come to Canada, as we call it. Yeah, so that is the kind of the thing that I'm working on. I'm also part of a research lab here. It's called the Digital Democracies Institute. And I don't know how to define it, but I'm going to try my best. It's sort of like an interdisciplinary research lab where we work at like understanding data science from a very like humanities, social science perspective. And so we have like people from like data science, computing science, and like communications, humanities, coming together and working on different aspects of how technology is implemented and used, and how like its history has been shaped, and what is at stake when we say AI is taking over things, you know?
Yeah.
And so like all the big questions, essentially. I'm part of that research lab, and I have been part of that for like 3 years, and that's how I like first started at Intravenous.
Oh my
goodness. Stuff. Because like, I was like, I have so much interesting things that I found through these research articles. I want to be talking about this. Like,
yeah.
I need to, because I feel like there is so much interesting stuff happening within the research world that it does not like always end up in the public discussions. And so I felt like there was a gap between the public dissemination part of research and things that happen within an academic institution. So I felt like maybe radio is a good way for me to do that kind of work, like the mediation. Mm-hmm. Because I was also like part of the student newspaper that we have. So like trying to like do my part and sort of bridging the gap between public knowledge and then research knowledge, so to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when we did that episode, either a couple of weeks or a couple of months ago.
Can't remember.
I remember when Robin told me, if she was like, if you want to sit in or take part, let me know. And when I was like, oh, what's the topic? And I was like, I've never heard of data feminism. And I do sociology. I was like, this is a type of feminism I've never heard of. And thinking like I've been studying, like I'm 20 now and I've been studying sociology since I was 16. And I've not come across data feminism at all. And I was like, that seems wrong. Like, it just kind of seems a bit wrong. I mean, we touch upon feminism as, like, quite a large topic. And to know that there was a whole subsection that this has been, like, not dropped, but just not acknowledged. Yeah. And
well, to be fair, it's a 2020 book, the book that you referred to, Data Feminism. So
yeah.
It's, like, quite recent in that sense.
Mm.
Because, like, sociology for me, not to shade on the entire discipline, but it's sometimes so attached to, like, its own, like, theoretical frameworks that it does not, like, go beyond doing that. And I feel like communications is kind of relatively new as a discipline itself. And so, like, a lot of the questions, the communication studies and, like, things that I come across are nuanced and and different and sort of new in that sense. And I feel like sociology is such a, like, old, like, not in the sense of the bad old, but, like, it's such a very, like, sort of, like, an institution that has been there for so long, like, sociology as a department itself. And also, I feel like data feminism is not necessarily a part of, like, the feminist movements, mm-hmm. like, we talk about them. So, like, people say that we are in the fourth wave of feminism or something right now, which I don't know if I necessarily agree or not. But data feminism, actually, this book questions and centers, like, feminist ideals when talking about data. So that's, I don't think it necessarily is a type of feminism, mm-hmm. but it is a way of looking at data through a feminist lens, if that's kind of, like, a distinction that I'd like to make. And I actually came across this one when I was taking a course with my MA supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
She's fantastic. She does, like, such good work. And she actually gifted me this book.
That is so lucky. Yeah. I wish like my professor and stuff would be like, hey, I have this book.
Yeah, she said, like, your thoughts, I think, match, or, like, the things that you have been thinking about. I think this book will help you, like, think through all those questions and thoughts that you have. And she's like, you should read it. That's how my supervisor is. Like, she'll just give me books. She's like, take this book. I think you'll find it helpful.
And it's like, and come back and we can have a chat.
I know. It's always that. So I'm really thankful to be able to, like, introduce to this, sort of. But before that, also, like, I was looking at, like, history of, like, science and math a little bit. Mm-hmm. And also, like, how imaginations of what technology can do for us, how it can be used and implemented. So the mythology of implementing technology has been something that I've been looking at. I think broadly that, again, falls into this umbrella of science and technology studies, because studying how science and technology kind of, like, get implemented and what kind of power relations it is embedded in, how it is trained, how it is, like, coded, how it's being distributed for people to use, and all those questions.
See, I find it kind of very strange that I was so interested in this topic after our last conversation, because I hate basically anything STEM. I'm not a STEM person. I couldn't wait to drop all of the STEM subjects when I was, like, 16, get as far away from it as possible. It just didn't work with me. And then to come here where it's kind of interlinked with what I do now, I never thought I would be so interested in it, to the point where I was like, let me do my own intravenous episode based on it. And I bet, like, my parents at home are thinking, God, what's happened? Like, something's gone turned. Wrong.
Tables have turned.
Yeah. Especially, like, looking into AI as well and how that's come about. I've kind of always just seen AI and been like, oh, okay, AI's a thing. I don't really care much about how it's become a thing, but it's a thing now.
Yeah.
But now, looking back at it and thinking through, like, this feminist lens and looking at what's going on behind the scenes as AI is developing and becoming more prominent in our society. I mean, you see it now, like, students using ChatGPT all the time. Like, I know when people say AI and it's like ChatGPT is the first thing that comes up, but when it's like that and it's becoming more prominent in our society and in our daily life, to be looking behind it and thinking, well, actually, are we just going to find this and just use it and not question anything about it, type of thing.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see where this discussion goes.
Yeah, I think the givenness of, like, AI that you just mentioned has been the case with, like, a lot of different things. For example, like, for me, like, I'm a Gen Z, so like, internet for me is, like, just such a given thing that when I was, like, growing up, I knew, like, I was gonna ask all the questions to Google. I wouldn't ask it to my parents or my peers. I just Google stuff.
Yeah.
It's just such a habitual thing. And that has been the case with, like, AI. And I feel like generations coming up would consider AI as being that thing. For us, it was internet. And for, like, perhaps, like, our parents or, like, our cousins, it was the computer, the personal computer, because computers were not given. They are a very recent invention.
Yeah. I remember my mom saying, well, at least you didn't have to keep going to the library to find out everything. You could just use Google from your home to do your homework. And I was thinking, really? Wow. You didn't have Google? Thinking like, it's that new? It's like, I remember when I found out, like, when YouTube was invented, and it was, like, 2005
5 or 6, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, my God, I was alive, because I was born in 2004. And I'm thinking, I was alive and YouTube didn't exist. I mean, yeah, I was one, but it didn't exist when I was alive. I was thinking, what?
Yeah.
So weird.
It feels so weird.
Yeah.
Even, like, Instagram and, like, Snapchat and stuff, they're pretty, like, pretty new.
Yeah, no, definitely.
But they have been so, like, embedded in our, like, day-to-day lives that it's really hard to question or think about it deeply. And that's why I think it's important to, like, extend those conversations about AI. Because what is AI? The word stands for artificial intelligence. But, like, psychologists and, like, sociologists and, like, a lot of, like, media scholars have been looking at, like, what does it mean to call intelligence artificial? Does, like, AI even do any intelligent stuff? Or is it just, like, it's just like Google, but just manufacturing answers? Like, for example, ChatGPT always, like, the example that she suggested. So what happens is with a lot of things like ChatGPT, they are trained, these models are trained on data available on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so essentially what it is doing is it will, like, code. And it will say that, okay, let's capture all the data that's available on public-facing websites. So it will collect all that information, and it will synthesize all the information. So essentially, it's just doing a work of summary, creating a summary and a catalog of the entire internet.
Right.
And whenever you, like, ask a question, you use certain keywords to prompt it to give you certain answers, just as Google works.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally not doing anything new. So, like, to call it intelligent, I mean, in itself is kind of questionable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that's how it worked. And that it's essentially just Google. It's like if you say that to someone, it's be like, so yeah, ChatGPT, that's your Google, basically. Like, and I've noticed now as well, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's called Gemini or something.
Yeah.
Because I've now noticed, like, on my phone, if I type into Google, there's an AI response first and then links.
Yeah. It's the same thing, like, remember, like, when we used to, like, chat and stuff, like, there used to be, like, text completion, like, prompts. Now there's, like, an AI version that does that. If you, like, search something on Google, there will be a box which says AI, like, the Google AI suggests that you want to search this. So, like, this is interesting because the newness in these technologies is not that new in that sense.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't believe, like, I have looked into, and people, researchers have looked into, like, archives of the 1960s and 70s, and artificial intelligence as an idea has been, like, existing, like, for too long. And they have been, like, trying so hard to create technology that actually does that. And I'm going to argue that still they haven't been able to do the things that they claim that they have done with AI.
Mm-hmm.
It's still not autonomous. So it's not going to do anything on its own.
Yeah.
It's not going to be able to update itself on its own, the information that it gets, the information that it scrapes from the internet. There's lots of problems with, like, thinking about ChatGPT as being representative of the world, because a lot of the, like, information that is on internet, for example, is, like, English, is in English as language. And then a lot of it comes from certain parts of the world and does not come from, like, other parts of the world. So when we ask questions to ChatGPT or Google, for example, the knowledge that it's producing and giving you is essentially going to be those coming from those places and never be represented from, like, other parts of the world.
Yeah, because if it's using data sets and it's being trained on data sets, I mean, we get taught this in sociology all the time, is like data is not fully, it can never be fully representative and it can never be fully, like, generalizable, because there'll be people, for example, sending out a survey, there'll be people in the population that are the hidden population that are not gonna appear on that survey. So if you're training it on data from that, you're instantly missing so many gaps. Wherever you are,
absolutely,
from parts of the world, from a small community, you're going to be missing the gaps.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And the problem is that, like, so there's also a narrative which exists, which says, well, there's only two ways that AI will go. It will either replace every human, like...
take over the world.
Yeah, in every aspect.
Yeah.
Be it, like, teaching, be it, like, writing essays,
mm-hmm.
like, all those different things. Or it's going to be so useless that it's not going to be... there's not going to be a new iteration of that. Because, for example, like, for the first case, like, I feel like in teaching, like, applying AI in teaching, for example, it's so interesting because a lot of the academic world was, like, shocked when, like, people were using ChatGPT
yeah.
to write their essays. But people were doing that before that, too. Like, they were just, like, copy and pasting Wikipedia articles.
Mm-hmm.
for their essays.
And, like, changing the couple of words
yeah.
and then be like, what do you mean I wrote yeah. that?
So it's definitely not a new phenomenon in that sense. Like,
yeah.
it's not as transformational as we think it would be. And the problem, and why it's important to problematize that vision is because a lot of the, like, Silicon Valley, so there's a, I don't know if you know, Silicon Valley is
yeah.
the, yeah, is the hub of, like, where all these inventions, so-called inventions happen. All the funding, they get tons of funding to
mm-hmm.
design all these, like, fancy-looking technologies that would replace human intelligence, creativity, agency, and remove the bias, remove everything, because since it's a machine, it does not have a bias. It
yeah.
is going to be very neutral when
yeah.
it's not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I just feel it's hilarious for me whenever, like, Elon Musk, for example, says that he's going to, like create microchips for the brain or
mm-hmm.
take rovers to Mars and, like, take people to the Mars and create
mm-hmm.
a new life there. And, like, Also, another thing that is hilarious to me is, like, the way, like, Elon Musk and, like, all these, like, dudes in the Silicon Valley, they have, like, a very specific way in which they, like, portray themselves. Like, they'll always wear, like, a t-shirt
mm-hmm.
to, like, appear very informal, very, like, innovative. So, like, very entrepreneurial, and I don't know how to say it.
Entrepreneur-like?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. tongue twister. that, oh, believe in me because I am the one who is going to change or innovate
mm-hmm.
in ways in which things have never been done before. But that's not how innovation or new technologies actually come to being, a lot of them.
Yeah.
It's never these guys doing anything.
Yeah. And I think as well as what you're saying with them, like, they're dressed very informal, very, like, t-shirt, casual, to be, like, almost, yeah, relate to me. Like,
yeah.
I'm, like, one of you, and look at what I'm doing.
Yeah. It's the same with, like, Sundar Pichai, who's, like, the CEO for Google, and then there's, like, Steve Jobs and everything. They'll never be, or, like, formal clothes because
mm-hmm.
they want to be, like, approachable. They want to sort of push this myth that innovation is such a, like, human thing that, like,
mm-hmm.
everybody should be able to do it.
Yeah.
And that, like, if you come to Silicon Valley and give me the funding, I will get things done for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole, like, performance of that myth is important and central to Silicon Valley
mm-hmm.
and the kind of funding it gets from different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting as well that you look at who it is in this, that they're all guys.
Yeah.
All men yeah. that are doing that. And I would say you compare that to women and how they try and dress in order to just gain a bit of respect in the workplace, no matter which workplace they're in. You'll find probably women are dressed way more like business and forward to
yeah.
be like, I need to get the respect
exactly.
to be here.
Yeah.
And you have these guys that are getting a load of funding, dressed casual, just being like, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I find that shocks me so much in, like, a parallel
yeah.
of it.
That's the same thing with, like, how, like, Trump dresses and how, like, Kamala has to dress so that people can take her seriously.
Yeah.
She has to, like, maintain a certain aura.
Mm-hmm.
Her speech has to be of a certain, like, level so that she seems to be a president, like, presidential candidate material. She
mm-hmm.
has to prove that time and again.
Yeah.
Whereas Trump gets on stage and says whatever he wants to.
Mm-hmm. And failing to, like, account for the fact that he's on trial.
Exactly.
It's
hilarious
yeah.
how he did that.
Yeah. And it's like, it's, people would say, oh, we've like come leaps and bounds in terms of gender equality and equality in a lot of different aspects, right?
Yeah.
And I agree we've come a certain point.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say we've come like leaps and bounds for a little while.
Yeah.
I just think it's like, it's not noticeable enough anymore for people, because it's not as starking in society. It's kind of learned to hide itself away in subtle things like this.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there a female candidate that's having to constantly prove she's worthy of being a president against a man that's on trial for a crime?
Mm-hmm.
But no one seems to put those two together, just because it's not like she's got no income relying on her husband, 1950s housewife.
Yeah.
And he's like businessman, bread maker type of difference.
Exactly.
It's same with the clothing.
Yeah.
It's so subtle and so hidden that people, I think, often forget that we're not as far along as we like to think we are. Because I've had a couple of discussions with my friends that are guys, like, over the years, where they're like, oh, but like the gender pay gap's not that bad. Like, I hear about it in the news, it's getting better. And I'm thinking, it's still a starking percentage difference.
Yeah.
It's just slowed down. Like, there was a time where, yeah, it made like a pretty big jump because women were getting paid. Just full stop. And then it's kind of slowed up, because it's like, oh, well, you're getting paid now. We see you've done it.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
Also, not to mention like the bias that happens like under the table that is not visible.
Mm.
These are like, so pay, for example, is a very like tangent. Like, you can see when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
The gap is very apparent. Whereas I think a lot of the things that happen with data and algorithms, which train and run these machine learning models and AI tools that we talk about, are so like hidden. And sometimes I think it's hidden out of purpose, because they want to obscure and create a version that suits them. The version of it, like a true, neutral, rational science as compared to subjective feminist, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, one really interesting thing that I found when I was sort of researching for today and looking at things was that there was an article about what it would mean to have a feminist AI.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, like, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of this term, but recidivism, which it's the likelihood of an offender to reoffend, but those rates are significantly overpredicted for Black people and underpredicted for white people. And if you translate that into all biases and all prejudice that AI will be getting programmed with, you're looking at something that people are using to help with their education, to help with bettering, I wouldn't even actually say bettering themselves, because you're kind of doing less work, but through education and writing your essays and helping you research, you're fueling into something that is perpetuating these